76 years of a struggle for liberation.
The chairman of police stormed the event during a speech by the Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sitta, who addressed the conference via video link because he had been not allowed to enter Germany. Police said he was subject to a ban on political activity in the country.
The Palestine Congress was happening. We were watching a video. The police came and shut down the electricity. They didn't give a justification about it. They didn't tell us why. Nevertheless, the police came here, shut it down, said it in the loudspeaker. People are supposed to leave the building right now. You see, they're already taking people.
Chaotic scenes followed. At least two people were arrested inside the hall and several others were interrogated. German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser hailed the police, saying it was good how the police had reacted.
An hour after the start of the conference, German police stormed the conference hall because of a speech on the history of Palestine. In an act of extreme repression, they broke up the conference, declaring it an illegal assembly. However, the Palestine Solidarity Movement vows to continue the conference. Dieter Reinisch from Berlin.
Just one day after France's foreign minister earned praise for saying that sanctions on Israel could be coming over their refusal to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza, he quickly backtracked in a session before Parliament. Many are saying the episode revealed the uniquely powerful sway Zionism has in France.
France, although it has the biggest Jewish community in Europe, has also the most extreme right-wing anti-Palestinian Jewish community in Europe. And this this Jewish community in France has a lot of saying and a lot of control over the media, over the political class. So you have very few people within this community who are protesting what's going on in the Middle East. Not like the United States and Great Britain.
The majority of France's Jews fled from former French colonies in Africa once those countries gained independence in the 1950s and 1960s, and they reportedly brought with them stringent anti-Arab and pro-imperialist views. In 2019, French Parliament controversially and incorrectly equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and they are currently reviewing a proposal to fully criminalize anti-Zionism.
They're saying straight, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Therefore, any criticism of Zionism, any criticism of Israel, means you are a criminal because you're an anti-Semite. And so it's killing all debate. Now, all throughout the collective West, but especially in France, the number one threat to freedom of speech is the Zionist movement and the pro-Israeli movement. And I weigh my words because it's very, very dangerous to say something like that in France because you'll find yourself in court.
Since October 7th, support for Hamas and even support for Palestine is often being prosecuted as so-called apology for terrorism. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations were banned nationwide for weeks, leading to thousands of fines on protesters, with protesters arrested and prosecuted for apology for terrorism for as little as carrying a Palestinian flag. Without the ability to openly criticize the policies of Israel, many believe it's difficult to imagine that Paris will reduce its unconditional support for Tel Aviv, no matter how many atrocities and war crimes they commit against Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has released a new statement following Sunday's drone attack on Russian-held Zaporizhzhia power plant in eastern Ukraine. Tajani said the risk of creating a new Chernobyl must be averted and that a free zone around the nuclear plant must be immediately declared. He also advised against fighting in the vicinity of the nuclear plant. A few days ago, during a celebration for the 75th NATO anniversary, Tajani hinted at the possibility of resuming ties with Russia in the future.
We are not at war with Russia. We criticize Moscow's policies, but we are not at war with the Russian people, and we definitely intend to resume relations with the Russian people.
It is the first time Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, has been targeted in military action since November 2022. On Tuesday, Russia blamed Ukraine for launching drone attacks on the plant for a third day, but Ukraine denied an involvement.
The Italian Foreign Ministry's position on the nuclear plant attack is very interesting. Rome, for the first time since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, is not just taking the side of Kiev, but it is pragmatically looking at the interests of the whole of Europe, without focusing on who is to blame for the attack.
Also on Tuesday, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated a warning that the UN's atomic watchdog IAEA issued earlier this week. Borrell said the reckless drone attack in Zaporizhzhia increases the risk of a dangerous nuclear accident.
Italy has often reaffirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine, despite Russia's warning against such moves. The Italian government has so far approved 6 military support packages to Kiev, inclusive of both lethal and non-lethal equipment and specialized military training activities. Max Civili, Rome.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, the main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress Party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress Party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income, and better health insurance payouts. The Congress Party accused Modi's BJP of threatening the constitution.
Our party has been crippled using tax agencies. Is it level playing ground? This is not only Congress Party. They will also do same with media houses. So we need to save democracy and constitution. We have to unite against autocratic policies of the BJP government.
accusing Modi's BJP of crippling his party by freezing its bank account in tax dispute. The opposition party manifesto has vowed to undo BJP policies if the party comes to power, promising that all anti-people laws passed by the ruling BJP without proper democratic process will thoroughly be reviewed and changed, including a much-debated electoral bond controversy. The party is sure to address issues related to minorities, communal conflicts, mob lynching and cattle killings, bulldozer politics and suppression of human rights, and shrinking dissent. The Congress Party, the main challenger to the BJP, hopes to mount a challenge to Modi's BJP by joining hands with regional parties. The ruling party has, however, downplayed Congress Party's manifesto as a bundle of lies, saying they ruled for 50 years, which is now a divided house of leaders working for personal interests.
In 2014, Modi's ruling BJP gained popularity among India's Hindu majority, promising revolutionary changes in the country, including a crackdown on corruption and economic prosperity. Critics, however, argue another term for the ruling BJP would undermine India's status as a secular democracy, as the ruling party's broader agenda is to transform India into a Hindu supremacist nation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran, in an impressive display of strength, accuracy, and technological prowess, sent hundreds of drones and missiles towards the Zionist-occupied territories during its retaliatory operation against the regime. Despite the Iron Dome and help from the United States, the UK, France, and Jordan in shooting down the drones, the Iranian missiles hit their targets, which were two bases. The Nevatim military base and the Ramon air base were hit with accuracy. Now, the paradigm in the region has been changed. What does it mean for the regime, the region, and the world? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Montreal, Yves Englert, author and political activist. And out of Brussels, Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst. Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Montreal. And Yves, well, Iran's retaliatory operation was initiated due to the Israeli regime's attack on Iran's consular section of the embassy in Damascus on April the 1st. Now, Tehran has cited Article 51, the Charter of the United Nations, and its right to self-defense. Your assessment of Iran's right to have carried out this strike?
Well, I'm not a lawyer or an expert in international law, but clearly Israel violated Iranian sovereignty in murdering a number of Iranian officials, including top generals, 2 weeks ago. And Israel has, of course, killed many Iranians in Syria over recent years, and also even is alleged to have been behind a whole series of operations within Israel or within Iran that have killed different officials over the years. So I think that it's clear that Israel violated international law, and it seems at least a plausible argument that Iran had the right, according to international law, to respond to Israel's aggression. So I I'm not a lawyer, but on the surface of it, it seems that Iran obviously had a right to respond to Israel's crass, brazen violation of international law.
Okay. Well, Gilbert, there are major attempts now to downplay the success of Iran's True Promise operation. What is your perspective regarding the operation and the overall effectiveness of the strike?
I think the operation has to be looked at two levels, tactical and strategic. If it's a tactical level, at a minimum, the Iranian attack provided important intelligence information to Iran on the components and location of those components in the Israeli Iron Dome and air defense levels, because they have several different systems in operation. At the tactical level, the mission was disputed. As you have noted, that Iran claimed success in hitting its two military objects that were essential to its retaliatory response, whereas Western media tend to ignore or even to deny that any significant damage was done. That remains to be appraised in the future. However, the very fact that Iran responded in this way, that in the first time ever in its history has directly struck the territory of Israel, that sent a message through the whole community in the Middle East, which has a strategic level of importance, namely the clear warning that Iran issued and that has to be taken seriously given the actions of this past weekend, that the warning that it made to other Gulf states, that, and in particular states which are home to American military bases and operational centers, such as Bahrain is. And these warnings were that if you facilitate the counterattack that one may expect or think will happen from Israel in response to this weekend's massive drone and ballistic missile and cruise missile attack on Israel, if you facilitate an Israeli response, we will bomb you. The fact is that none of the players in the Middle East wants to be brought into the war directly. And so what has happened as a consequence of this exercise by Iran, a limited exercise over the weekend, is that the neighbors are withdrawing their permission for the United States to operate and to use the airspace of these countries to support Israel in any future counterattack. Now, that is something that Iran has strived to achieve over decades, and it seems to have been achieved in one weekend. So at a tactical level, there may be disputes over what was actually done on the ground. There is no dispute that Iran showed it is capable of self-confident in pursuing a military confrontation with Israel, if that is what has to happen. And at a strategic level, it has changed the game in the Middle East because all the neighboring states have backed away from the United States.
Okay, well, Yves, no country has dared to attack inside of the Israeli regime to the Western hegemonic front's unwavering support for the regime, but Iran chose to do it and has been effective. Now, your thoughts on the overall attack, and is it a game changer? Iran was able to penetrate several layers of defense from the regime itself and also from the United States, France, the UK, and Jordan. That in itself is extremely effective. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree with my co-panelists' assessment to a large extent. I think this is significant. There's a kind of two different angles being done in the Canadian and Western media. On one hand, saying that Iran has drastically escalated things, and then at the same time saying that Iran has been unsuccessful, which is a little bit in contradiction with each other. So, you know, whether this is going to be a game changer for the region, I'm a little bit hesitant on that front. I think that I'm made scared by the situation, because I think that there really are fanatics in charge of the Israeli government and military, and I think that even if the U.S. and others have tried to warn Israel to not do something really crazy in response, I think there's a decent chance that the Netanyahu government will do a launch something that is a huge escalation from an already tense situation, and that could spiral into something even bigger. But I think that to me the hope here is that Israel is restrained in terms of its response to Iran, and also that Israel and the other countries in the region that have, you know, like Jordan, for instance, that, you know, helped shoot down drones, that this puts a whole lot of pressure on that government to do more to end the genocide in Gaza, and that the Israel is put more on the back foot in its policy in Gaza. But at this point, I don't think it's clear, you know, what the Israeli reaction is going to be, and if the most crazy elements of the Israeli government will be restrained.
Okay, well, Gilbert, Iran says its goals of the operation were deterring, punishing, and warning the Zionist regime. Do you think that it reached its goals?
I think it has. Well, of course, we'll know in the coming days whether the Israeli government acts rationally or pursues an emotional response that is self-destructive. It has been stated in the Western press that the Iranian attack was the largest in scale use of drones and other missiles to at a single day. This was 320 or something like that objects, missiles, and other objects sent away to Israel. However, let's look at the numbers. This is a numbers game, and you have to consider the potential of Iran to deliver a devastating, or more than one devastating, attack on the very compact geography of Israel is overwhelmingly clear. The numbers of missiles in the Iranian inventory, including the most recent, most modern, and most destructive missiles that number several thousand, can be as many as 10,000. So in this respect, what happened over the weekend was only indicative and a warning of what can come. There is no way that a massive, genuinely massive, missile strike against Israel can be turned back by an Iron Dome or any other air defense system. So in this context, any action by Israel that wants to be a macho is going to be self-destructive.
Okay, well, your thoughts about that, Eves, because if, according to Gilbert, if the Israeli regime understands that any action they will take will be self-destructive, because I want to go back to what you said and when you talked about the regime and the possibility of actually now them initiating an attack. But how logical would that be when even Iran has not used its more sophisticated missiles, but still were able to penetrate? Now, Iran is saying that it did not want to cause any major damage. It wanted to send a message, and it sent that message by hitting those two bases. It also did not want to hit any civilian areas, which perhaps can be a lesson for the Israeli regime. Your thoughts on that side of things?
Well, I think the Israelis are caught, because the Israelis want to this you know, psycho power that unleashes far more destruction on anyone else than is ever committed on them is part of their whole raison d'être, the how they operate. And obviously we see that in Gaza, that, you know, in response to the October 7th, they feel the need to demonstrate how violent and try to scare the whole region. So Israel wants to operate like that. So I think the general ethos from the Israeli government is going to be to respond in that way. And also, I think the fact that they are failing in their stated objectives in Gaza, in that they haven't got the hostages and Hamas is still able to operate, that makes them want to lash out even more. But I agree that the likely response, if Israel does go, let's call it crazy in its response to Iran, then there's going to be a lot of damage in Israel. And the Israeli public is, you know, their little bubble's going to burst. The reality is even despite October 7th, Israelis have lived a fairly quiet existence while occupying and brutalizing Palestinians. But I wouldn't put it past the Netanyahu government to pursue something that's on the very escalatory side of a response. I would assume there's going to be some response from Israel. I don't think Israel is going to be able to not respond in any way. I think the Israeli military and the Israeli government are caught in a difficult position from their standpoint, in that they want to be the bully that gets to do all the killing and gets to do all the damage and not have any impact or very little impact on Israeli society. And now they've been confronted with the fact that much of Israel could be destroyed if they try to keep up that bully posture.
Hmm. Well, Gilbert, Iran has said that they have not shown the most of their ability. They just wanted to send this message and serve as a deterrent. However, that if the Israeli regime continues with its aggression, that it will definitely respond in much harsher ways inside of the regime. Your thoughts about, first of all, what Iran is saying, and second of all, how likely can that serve as a deterrent in itself?
Well, the Israelis are very dependent on the United States and other allies to enable their very powerful armed forces to maintain that posture of strength. And as the warning of Iran regarding how it will behave should there be a forceful Israeli response to this latest weekend's events, that has, as I said, frightened the neighborhood and sobered up the neighborhood so that they are stepping away from the United States. But Mr. Biden has urged caution on Israel is not a matter of his humanitarian disposition. It is a realization that American bases in the neighborhood are hostage to Israeli actions. And the head of the regional operational center for the United States is under threat. The base of the Fifth Fleet is under threat, under massive threat that Iran can carry out, depending on what the Israelis do next. Now, if we have to look at what the Israelis would like to do, what Netanyahu would like to do, we don't have to guess. He has talked about it for the last 5 or 10 years. He would like to destroy the alleged Iranian nuclear program, that is, weaponry. And here, Mr. Netanyahu is totally dependent on American support, because the facilities in Iran are at a great distance from Israel, and Israeli planes can achieve missions only with the help of American tanker planes. Mr. Biden would have to then be in the midst of any Israeli attack, and it's hardly credible that he will do that now, given the vulnerability of American assets in the region. So what Israelis could do, how they could realize their dreams, it is unforeseeable. It is improbable that their dreams can be fulfilled and that they can do damage of a great significance to Iran. Iran is vastly larger. It is 10 times bigger population. It is inconceivable that Israel could deliver a damage to Iran that would not be immediately turned into destruction of Israel. So I think that however hot heads may exist in the Israeli cabinet, and there are at least two of them who are quite prominent in their rabid remarks, I don't think that they can prevail against the common sense and the sense of self-preservation of their colleagues.
Well, your thoughts, Yves, on the significance of the United States not getting involved and coming so far to the aid of the Zionists to attack Iran. Gilbert pointed out some points, but I'd like to hear your perspective.
Well, the U.S. did help in shooting down and destroying some of the drones and missiles. So the U.S. has provided help, and they, of course, provide innumerable forms of support to the Israeli military at all times, and intelligence and weapons, et cetera, et cetera. Whether they will directly enable Israel to strike nuclear facilities in Iran, I would venture to guess they won't. I agree with that. We don't know. The U.S. tried to say they had no role in the attack on April 1st. I don't know if that's correct or not. In a direct sense, it may be correct, but indirectly, there's so many ways in which they enabled Israeli military, and also the fact that they failed to condemn the attack. A sort of tacit endorsement of what Israel did. I think the U.S. is divided. Also, I think this is, one of the things that Israel obviously wants to draw the U.S. into fighting Iran as much as possible. And I don't think it's just around destroying an alleged nuclear program. I think they would probably Israel would like to see the U.S. just, destroy Iran generally. And certainly, destroy as much of its military as possible. I still think that Biden is so wildly pro-Israel, and there's so many of the upper echelons of his administration that are so wildly pro-Israel that and so much of the Republican and the political culture in the U.S. is so pro-Israel. I think there's still a possibility here that Israel does something very aggressive in its response. And the U.S. is sucked into defending Israel and fighting Iran in a more kind of direct sense. So I think that's definitely a possibility. And there's just so many ways in which all that can escalate too. I mean, the more bombings in Syria, and there's obviously Russian forces in Syria, and you could draw in obviously Hezbollah will be part of this. But there's a lot of ways in which this can escalate quite quickly. But I don't think that I wouldn't put it past the fact that the Biden administration will end up being directly involved against Iran on behalf of Israel.
And your thoughts, Gilbert, where this could go? Because on the one hand, we have the resistance front and their allies. We're looking at, of course, the traditional resistance front, and we also have with Russia and China now coming out and supporting Iran's right to initiate that retaliatory attack. I mean, your overall assessment of where this can go at this point in time?
Well, it can go in all directions, and it can take us to a very dramatic change in global economics. Iran has many possibilities of defending itself and imposing enormous pain on those who attack it. The last week, we all learned about the taking of a merchant vessel, container vessel, Israeli owned in the Straits of Hormuz, and it's being directed to Iranian port. The Straits of Hormuz are under close watch of Iran, which has ground to naval vessel attack missiles capable of closing the straits and strangling the global movement of natural gas and oil. That is to say, the amount of pain that any of Iran's enemies can think of imposing on Iran is held in check by the reality of the pain that Iran can impose on the world at large. So I am skeptical that this will go off in a wild direction, since all parties are aware of just what I just said. However, tit for tat at a less than awful level are foreseeable or possible, and I sincerely hope that the conflict will remain contained.
Okay. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Yves Zinkler, author and political activist out of Montreal. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Limelight.
Journalists in Western corporate and so-called public media, whether it is the BBC, CBC, CNN, the New York Times, or the Washington Post, know exactly what is happening in Gaza. They know there is a genocide because they see the same images the rest of us see, filmed by brave Palestinian journalists and ordinary citizens. They all know what the judges of the International Court of Justice decided. And yet, these truths are kept out of US and European media. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Mark Esper, current CNN Global Affairs analyst and former defense secretary for President Donald Trump, lasting all of 16 months in the position, presented erroneous information last week to CNN viewers. On February 29th, CNN anchor John Berman asked him about what has become known as the Flower Bag Massacre. He said, "We've just seen in the reporting out of Gaza maybe 100 people killed while waiting for aid. The humanitarian situation in Gaza, how much of a threat is that to hopes for peace there, to hopes for Israel to achieve what they want to achieve?" Setting aside Berman's apparent frustration at the starvation interfering with the Zionist regime's devastating onslaught in Gaza, Esper's answer bears close examination. Esper acknowledged that Israel has a responsibility under international humanitarian law to provide food and aid to the civilians in Gaza, but it was downhill from there. He quickly shifted to pure speculation, propaganda for the American viewer. He claimed, "There are concerns, of course, have been for many years, that food aid coming in is rife with you. You know, arms and ammunition for Hamas, and that maybe Hamas is also pilfering it. Reports, early reports from this incident are maybe that that was happening, and then Israel opened fire or maybe a stampede happened." It's not clear what Esper is trying to convey to the viewer. Is he saying that the resistance group Hamas was trying to smuggle in arms and ammunition when the Zionist regime forces opened fire and killed 112 Palestinians while injuring another 760, according to the Gaza Health Ministry? If so, there has been zero evidence presented of arms smuggling in that convoy. The Zionist regime, after all, is checking everything trucked into Gaza. Alternatively, he may only be suggesting that the resistance group Hamas was pilfering the aid. Similarly, no evidence of Hamas taking that aid has been presented. As for desperate people being trampled along with deadly Israeli regime fire, the occupying power starving Palestinians would be responsible for both. Esper, unsurprisingly, says nothing about the Zionist regime's genocidal policies in the Gaza Strip. Perhaps he doesn't believe it, but as an analyst, he should note the International Court of Justice views this as a genocide. There is not a word from him in the op-ed about the consequences of this policy for over 12,500 Palestinian children killed by the Israeli regime attack. Nor does he mention the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians facing starvation, with 15 Palestinian children now dead of dehydration and malnutrition, as even CNN is hesitantly reporting. Esper further fails to raise the importance of prosecuting the Zionist regime perpetrators of this genocide. Of course, he says nothing about dismantling the apartheid Israeli regime and replacing it with a regime securing equal rights for all, much as he was done in Jim Crow American South and apartheid South Africa. Deeper detail about the unequal reality facing Palestinians is not to be routinely broached at CNN. Instead, CNN has presented calls of "From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free" as anti-Semitic. Presumably, CNN also views equal rights in the context of one state as anti-Semitic. The New York Times, often quick to present the Zionist regime's position, did not entirely side with Esper's biased speculation about the convoy. They presented the views of witnesses, health officials, and the Zionist regime's military. Readers were advised, quote, witnesses described extensive shooting by Israeli forces amid widespread panic, and doctors at Gazan hospitals said that most of those killed and injured were by gunfire. Others were crushed under trucks, frantically trying to escape. Witnesses said the Gazan health officials called it a massacre, unquote. The authors, Aaron Boxerman and Adam Raskin, who months ago was critical of Al Jazeera and its Gaza bureau chief, Wael Tahtou, just days after Israeli fire killed his wife, 16-year-old son, and 6-year-old daughter, did dutifully note that the Zionist regime military had claimed its troops fired after individuals in the crowd approached them in a manner which endangered them. They write that the military attributed most of the deaths to a crush as hungry Palestinians sought to seize the cargo. A different New York Times article by Heba Yazbek and Boxerman cited Israeli military spokesperson Daniel Hagari as claiming Israeli troops shot in the air before firing only in the face of danger when the mob moved in a manner which endangered them. A CNN.com article cites Hagari as saying the tanks that were there to secure the convoy sees the Gazan being trampled and cautiously tries to disperse the mob with a few warning shots, unquote. The article also quotes Hagari as stating, I think as a military man, they were backing up securely, risking their own lives, not shooting at the mob, unquote. Esper's ongoing affinity for a genocidal apartheid army, he hasn't tweeted out any acknowledgement of error, is made all the more clear by the sort of rhetoric coming from the Zionist regime's military spokesperson, who on at least 3 occasions dismisses starving people as a mob. For Esper, it's a stampede. That same morning of February 29th, CNN anchor Kate Bouldon interviewed New York Governor Katie Hochul. Bouldon didn't ask one question about Hochul's genocidal comment earlier in the month to the United Jewish Appeal Federation of Jewish Philanthropies of New York, Incorporation. The CNN anchor also did not respond to the Electronic Intifada's inquiry about the absence of a question about Hochul's pushing genocide in Gaza. Hochul had declared, if Canada someday ever attacked Buffalo, I'm sorry, my friends, there would be no Canada the next day. Her implicit endorsement of a genocide wiping out Gaza and Canada was met with laughter rather than outrage from the audience attending the event. Hochul then added, clearly speaking of Gaza and her Canada, hypothetical, quote, that's a natural reaction. You have a right to defend yourself and to make sure it never happens again, unquote. She issued an apology the next day, but the damage was done. Hochul admitted to an inappropriate analogy, and according to New York Times, she apologized for her poor choice of words. She did not apologize to the Palestinian children her words helped to kill. Touting genocide is now casually dismissed as poor word choice, and starving people are a mob. American and Zionist officials have a lot to answer for if the International Court of Justice takes up its job responsibly.
are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.